Green Sense Radio is brought to you by Green Sense Farms. We're changing the world with sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Welcome to Green Sense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Thanks for joining us. I'm an environmental entrepreneur and founded GreenSense to make our listeners aware of good sustainable ideas that make common and economic sense.
I'm Bob Kessler, executive producer of the program. This week, you know, Robert, cities are really where all the action is when it comes to green. But what are the greenest cities in the U.S.? There's a very thorough ranking that looks at everything imaginable when it comes to being a green city. Food is medicine. We've been talking about that. And the disease lymphatic filariasis. This is the number one tropical disease, but hardly anyone outside of these poor countries has heard of it. Well, there's a way to prevent it thanks to a common food ingredient.
Well, that may be easy for you to say. I'm just going to call it LF. And that's all coming up on this week's edition of Green Sense. While sustainability and environmental management are part of the national discourse, it's at the individual city level where we're seeing the greenest action. And if you check out this new list, how well they're doing varies widely. Jill Gonzalez is an analyst with Wallet Hub, which published the new list of the greenest cities in America. It includes the 100 largest cities in the U.S. and ranks them, thanks to the work of a dozen environmental scientists and urban studies experts. Jill, welcome to Green Sense.
Thanks for having me.
Number one on the list is San Francisco. Let's look at what put them at the top of this list to better understand your ranking system. Many of the factors are obvious: per capita greenhouse gas emissions, percentage of commuters who drive, farmers markets per capita. The list factors in things like a bike score. How does a city earn a good bike score?
Sure. So the bike score and the walk score are actually done by the same company. And that really has to do with the share of bike lanes, sidewalks, et cetera, how many bikers there are, how many bike paths there are. And it actually really takes into consideration traffic congestion and those types of things that, you know, bike lanes are great, but are they accessible? Are they usable? And are drivers friendly toward them? So all of those things are looked at by the Walk Score company. And San Francisco ranked second best in the country for its bike score, third best for its walk score. So it's a very accessible city, as hilly as it is. You know, you can definitely get around there without a car.
What about complete streets? Do you look at that? Is that part of the score?
That would be part of the score, and that is done by a third-party company.
Of the top 10 of the cities on your list, six are in California: San Francisco, San Diego, Fremont, Sacramento, San Jose, and Irvine. And California has long been associated with the environmental movement. Would you say culture has an effect on the score?
Absolutely. I mean, culture is not something that we directly measure since this is a quantitative report, but I think indirectly, policy is very much shaped by culture within a state and then obviously within a city here. I think, you know, looking at the talk around the Paris Climate Accords, seeing what California has said on the record about moving forward as a state, and then seeing cities, you know, really adopt the same viewpoints that they've had, as you said, for decades.
Also, past governors have really set the bar for environmental standards and goals. How much has that affected the California cities?
It's really affected it hugely. So California has one of the highest percentage of its electricity that comes from renewable sources. So geothermal, hydroelectric, pumped storage, solar, all of those types of things. About a third of all of its electricity comes from those kinds of renewable sources. So that obviously sets the bar for the cities within the state very high. When it comes to solar energy, a lot of these cities have really committed to policies and regulations, not only on a residential level, but on a business level that really motivates businesses to turn to solar energy.
Was that looked at the ranking system? Was that included in how cities were ranked?
It was. We looked at both the percentage of electricity from renewable sources as well as solar PV installations per capita.
We mentioned in the introduction that a dozen of environmental scientists and urban studies experts help with the list. And the hard thing when you put a list together is coming up with objective criteria to rank any variable, in this case, the cities, without bias. But unfortunately, that's very difficult. Does this list have a built-in bias?
It doesn't. So we like to refer to it as a study, not just a list. You know, it does look at 22 actual scientific metrics here, ranging from mostly government-backed sources. So that, you know, alleviates some bias right there. We also look at most things on the per capita level so that the huge cities aren't necessarily at a more of an advantage than the smaller cities, which I think looking at the top 20 and even the top 10, you'll certainly see. So we try to really alleviate any type of bias that we can.
Well, six of the top 10 cities are from California, and many of them are very expensive to live in, and they favor an age demographics. Does that study take into consideration the wealth of a city to be sustainable? And does it favor any areas with a higher per capita income or maybe an age group?
Age, income, et cetera, was not included. Demographics were not included in the metrics here. You know, it really comes down to policy, to what type of energy a city is using, to air quality, water quality. So I would say most of those things wouldn't necessarily favor, you know, a younger demographic or anything like that. I think it really is policy focused.
I'm talking with Jill Gonzalez with Wallet Hub about the new list of the greenest cities in America that was recently published. I'm Robert Colangelo. Well, Jill, New York City is number 16, which is pretty good for a city once known for being dirty in terms of score. It's only 2 points behind Madison, Wisconsin, which has been considered, you know, a clean, modern city for a long time. What has New York City done to get such a high rank?
New York City has really done a few things. In fact, it's one of the first cities to plan out exactly how it's going to follow the Paris Climate Accords for the next 3 years. A lot of cities are actually following in New York's footsteps as far as regulations and policies that they can implement on the city level. So that, I think that that commitment that New York has shown really helps when it comes to these policy issues. Of course, New York kind of has some built-in things going for it. A lot of green space. Central Park certainly helps with that. About 20% of the city area is actually parkland. So that's huge, and that's just city proper. It also is number one when it comes to the percentage of commuters who are walking or using public transportation when it comes to going to work. Has the best walk score in the country, a very good bike score as well. Good public transportation programs. I know the metro is slower than usual right now, but that's certainly one of them. Bike sharing is also huge there. So New York, when it comes to transportation, when it comes to green policy and regulations, really has come a long way, as you said, from a few decades ago.
Well, I've had the pleasure of working with Mayor Bloomberg in the past. My expertise was brownfield redevelopment, so I can also speak to his leadership And again, just like Governor Schwarzenegger in California, I think a lot of these things came from the policy that was developed under his administration. What are your thoughts on that?
I think you're exactly right. And I think that's why we're seeing such strong initiatives continue to come out of the city. And again, really try to lead the way for cities that are trying to do the same thing, that maybe don't have as many of the resources as the biggest city in the country has. So I think we see, you know, a lot of smaller cities following in its footsteps. I think that before 2017 is through, we'll see a lot more regulatory stances come out of cities similar to New York size, but also much smaller.
Well, let's look at two Midwestern towns. Milwaukee's score is 52. Chicago's about 50, only 2 points different, but their rank is quite different. Milwaukee is a 37 and Chicago 55. So there are a lot of cities between the two with scores that are pretty close. Is that typical from one year to the next?
It is. You know, just to clarify for your listeners, you're talking about the overall score. So out of a 100 scale percentage system, that was the first number. Then we rank those accordingly, kind of comparative to how other cities fall. So out of 100 cities, you know, Milwaukee 37th, Madison 13th, obviously doing very well, Chicago 55th, so almost making the top half there. And a lot of numbers, Chicago actually did very well in top 10. As far as the number of smart energy policies and initiatives that it has, as far as the number of local programs for promoting the use of green energy, and that's to be expected of a bigger city. I think that when it comes to implementing a lot of these policies, that's where it has a little bit of ground to make up. I wouldn't be surprised if next year we do see it in the top 50.
Do cities use this list as a way to understand where they rank and to try to improve their score and standing?
Absolutely. I think even as a city official, as a mayor, as someone on city council, it's hard to see outside of your bubble, outside of your city, and say, you know what? I thought we were doing really well on this, but even compared to some of our Midwestern neighbors, we could be doing a lot better. What is Madison doing? You know, that's something that we've gotten a lot of questions about, to really look inside the numbers, because it's one thing to think that your drinking water is great, to think that your air quality is great, but the numbers don't lie. And that's why we really try to put forth these quantitative studies to not only help residents really see how they stack up, but obviously city officials to see where they're doing great and where they can use some improvement.
Green programs take time to actually see some type of a return on investment or environmental benefit. Toward the bottom of the list are some Rust Belt towns like Cleveland, Detroit, and Toledo. And they've made a lot of efforts to green up, but it doesn't help their ranking. Is this partly just because it takes time to actually see the value of these programs being implemented?
Absolutely. So it's one thing to see the value on an air quality or a water quality standpoint, right? I mean, obviously those things take time. It's another to see this money-wise. You know, are residents kind of being educated? Do they have policies that would help them convert to solar energy? Do business districts see that? It's hard with some of these Rust Belt cities like a Cleveland, like a Detroit, like a Toledo, where the environmental policies are certainly on their radar, but a lot of other things still are too. You know, when we're looking at basic infrastructure, when we're looking at still recovering from the recession. So unfortunately, environmental policies can be more prioritized in some cities than others.
Jill, thanks for joining us on Green Sense, and maybe we can have you back on next year to see how the list changed.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Jill Gonzalez with Wallet Hub, which published the new list of the greenest cities in America. I'm Robert Colangelo. This is Green Sense. Visit greensensefarms.com to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. We'll be right back.
This is Bob Kessler, executive producer of GreenSense Radio. Every week, we cover environmental issues and meet passionate people and sustainable innovators. You might have noticed we do it with very few commercials. Our advertisers, they're just part of what supports GreenSense. We need the help of our listeners, also passionate people who care about the planet and know the value of independent media, which matters now more than ever. We've just launched our fundraising drive so you can help us continue to bring you informative and inspiring shows. Your contributions will cover our small production staff, which seeks out and schedules interviews, edits them, and puts together GreenSense every week. Plus, there's the cost of online hosting and studio equipment. So when you visit greensensefarms.com, click on Radio Show to make a contribution via Podbean. It takes just a few minutes, and as we often say on the program, individual actions multiplied by millions can yield big results. So if you're inspired by our positive and informative shows, we're asking you to help keep GreenSense going. Visit greensensefarms.com and click Radio Show to contribute to our fundraising drive via Podbean. On behalf of all of us at GreenSense Radio, thank you. GreenSense Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with our sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
Next to mental illness, lymphatic filariasis is the leading cause of disability in the world. Many of us have never heard of it, but it's often an overlooked tropical disease, and food is a way to prevent it. It's been tried with great success in Haiti, thanks to a program with the University of Notre Dame. We're joined by James Reimer, who's with the Notre Dame Haiti program. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you.
Jim, what's LF, because I can't pronounce it, and why have so few of us heard of it?
Well, LF is also known in Haiti as more simply as Bigfoot. It's a disease that is borne by mosquitoes. It affects 120 million people in 80 countries, but very few people in the West have heard about it because it's a disease of the poorest of the poor.
And how common is this worldwide? Is it specific to certain geographic, or as you've just mentioned, is it really defined by socioeconomics?
It takes three elements. It takes poverty, it takes lack of sewer systems, and it takes out-of-control mosquito populations. And that generally is around the equator. And if you look at the map of the 80 countries involved, it's really around the equator in subtropical conditions.
I could think of places in America that have those conditions. Can you find it here?
Back in the 1700s and 1800s, it was very common in Charleston and New Orleans. But once the sewer systems got put in those cities, the disease was eliminated.
So part of the solution is infrastructure, but I also understand that you could prevent this by using salt. Tell us more about that.
More specifically, it's by putting the medicine that kills the worms in salt and using that to distribute to people in the food system. So when they consume the salt, they consume the medicine and the diseases stop.
And what is the medicine that's put in the salt?
Well, we call it a DEC. It's a tongue twister. It's called diethyl carbamazine citrate. So we'll just call it DEC.
And what does DEC do?
It kills the worm in the blood system. And so when a mosquito bites and takes blood out of someone that's infected, there's nothing to transmit to the next person the mosquito bites.
Is salt an important part of the delivery system, or does it have other benefits?
Salt has two important issues. One is it's a common staple good that everyone, pretty much everyone in the country, eats every day. So it's a great delivery system for the medicine. Secondly, when we're delivering that medicine, we can also add another additive, potassium iodide, to deliver iodine. So we get co-fortified salt, which gives a double benefit for the program.
Tell us a little bit about the Haiti program. What have you been doing there, and what is the importance of salt to Haiti?
Right. The Haiti program was started by Father Thomas Streit, a world-leading scientist and priest, in the mid-90s. And he's been working there for 25 years to control this disease and eliminate it. And it really involves three programs. One is pill-based, where you're giving out pills to kill the worms. Another is salt-based, which we do. And then a third is a clinic that takes care of people even after the disease is gone. They're still disfigured, so they need psychosocial care and help. And that's a third element of what we do to help the people that are affected by this disease.
Can the treatment cure you, or is this something that is persistent lifelong once you've gotten it?
You can cure the disease. You can get rid of the worms, as it were, but the disfigurement, once your lymph system has been compromised, then you have what the Haitians would call Bigfoot for the rest of your life. So that's one of the most difficult parts of the disease. You can cure it, but you can't take away the damage that has been done already.
Where else is this disease prevalent besides Haiti?
A lot of Southeast Asia. China was, southern China had a significant problem, but pretty much around the equator. So if there is a global coalition of companies and NGOs and governments working to eliminate it. But it's, if you look on the map, it pretty much goes around the equator.
Is DEC curative in all portions of the world?
It works in all situations in that. It is a very effective medicine against the disease.
Jim, how did you get involved with this? This sounds fascinating.
Well, I spent my career in before coming to Notre Dame with Cargill. And the last 10 years, I was involved with running the Latin American salt business. And we were helping Notre Dame at that point do clinical studies and providing salt. And I left Cargill and called up Father Tom and said, you'll have someone else to work with on this program in the future. And he said, well, as a matter of fact, I've been sitting here praying that God would send someone to help me. And one thing led to another, and now I'm wearing a Notre Dame hat, and it's been a blessing to help people in Haiti.
When you go to these locations that are so severely impoverished, it must just sadden your heart and must feel a bit overwhelming just with the breadth of social problems that they have there. How do you just focus on solving one issue?
Well, it's a good point, because if you've been in Haiti, you see some very difficult situations, people living in very tough things. And what we try to do is focus on the one thing we can do to make people, to lift the burden of disease. And so by doing one small thing well, we can make a big impact across the whole country. We're not going to solve all the issues in Haiti, but we can help with knocking out two tropical diseases that are really significant.
Well, what's next for the Notre Dame Haiti program? You're not only working on LF prevention, so tell us more.
So the first order of business is to get rid of the lymphatic filariasis, get that done in the next few years, and then we're tackling iodine deficiency disorders, which is 70% of the children in the country have iodine deficiency. And when that happens, they have cognitive impairment. So the next thing up is to take that, drop that down to zero, and effectively lift the IQ of the next generation of Haiti in a really dramatic fashion. And then third, take the model that we're developing and make it available to the other 80 countries that are working on the same problem.
Jim, thank you very much for letting us tell your story, and we hope this report reaches many a people and that you get some additional support on your efforts.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
That's James Reimer, who's with the Notre Dame Haiti Program. I'm Robert Colangelo, and this is GreenSense. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play when you visit greensensefarms.com. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Support our Podbean patron drive when you visit the Green Sense Farm website. Your contribution supports independent media like us, and it goes directly to pay for quality program so we can continue to bring you great guests. Bob, what are we going to learn next week?
You know, we hear a lot about how climate change will hurt our environment and make things more difficult physically, but it takes its toll mentally. There's a new study about that, and we can learn about, well, how to prevent climate change from getting us all stressed out.
Visit greensensefarms.com to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. And you can also check out the list of radio stations that air our show. Keep learning, because when you're green, you grow.
GreenSense Radio is brought to you by GreenSense Farms. We're changing the world with our sustainable indoor vertical farming, growing more with less. Our leafy greens are sold live, so they burst with flavor. Visit greensensefarms.com and watch us grow.
GreenSense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan. The program is copyright GreenSense Farms, all rights reserved.